My guest today is James Corbett. James is the founder and host and editor of The Corbett Report, an independent listener-supported alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues from 9/11 truth and false flag terror to the Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, the central banking fraud, and more. James Corbett, welcome back to the Vin Armani Show.
Thank you for having me back on. Pleasure to be here.
I am glad. I think now is the perfect time. We've had you on before to talk global politics and sort of the, I would like to talk now, if we could, about some of the conflicts that are coming up in the world. And I think you're kind of in the catbird seat there in Japan. I want to talk about that. And also, if we have some time, I'd love to just get into some talk about voluntarism in general. It's something that I feel like we don't get enough from you about that. I mean, I love interviews where you get a chance to actually talk about your ideological and philosophical stance. So I think we should definitely get into that. But because you're there in Japan, what I wanted to ask you about is I feel like the news that we're getting over here about what's occurring in North Korea, especially as it relates to the governments and populations of Korea and Japan, is really heavily stifled. Can you talk to us a little bit about where, because it feels to me like that there's like this is a pivotal moment for Japan, maybe one of the most pivotal moments in 60 or 70 years. Can you talk to us about what the state of things is like there with the conflict that's brewing over in North Korea?
Well, I think that you're right that the Western media doesn't quite get what is going on over here. And that's because, as usual, it goes through the Uncle Sam filter, where all history is anything that happened in the last 12 months and anything before that is ancient history that has no bearing on what's going on right now. And secondarily, I mean, everything revolves around the United States and its interests. And if it doesn't, you know, have to do with that directly, then it's not worth reporting. So I think in order to really understand the Korean situation and what's going on, we have to look back at least, you know, 23 years ago to the 1994 agreed framework, which was it was a process that was put in place that throughout the 1990s almost succeeded in renormalizing relations between the United States and North Korea. And what it essentially did was allow North Korea to pursue peaceful nuclear energy, light water reactors that couldn't be used for weapons programs, in return for basically opening up and starting to normalize relations with South Korea. This was in conjunction with the Sunshine Policy that the South Korean president at that time was attempting to bring in. So we're talking late 1990s here. And there was a period in which it seemed that North Korea might be ready to start opening up and normalizing relations. And then the neocons came in, right. And 2001 and the Axis of Evil and all of that, and they scuttled the agreed framework. And since that point, it's just been a series of escalations. So I think in order to really understand where we're at today, I mean, first of all, you have to understand that history and what the breakdown, in fact, the conscious sabotaging of the agreed framework that the neocons did. I mean, from the time that they came in, they were looking to basically scrap that whole plan and undermine the Sunshine Policy in any way they could. So that's where I think we start to see what's coming through today. And I think the other thing to consider is that North Korea and Kim Jong-un is generally portrayed as just total insanity. There's a total madman who's in charge of this, you know, nuclear arsenal of some sort, nuclear firecrackers when you look at the big picture. But at any rate, it's just total insanity. It's a madman. I think that does a disservice to the whole idea of what's going on here. I mean, what you have essentially is a government that has managed to maintain its rule over its people for whatever 70 plus years, despite the incredible pressure that has been brought to bear on it, right, by all parties, right, including some of its closest allies, but of course also including the United States. And I don't think a regime is able to sustain itself like that unless there's some rationality to what it's doing. And I think this fundamental part is that it is not irrational for a country like North Korea, in the situation it's in, to try to develop nuclear a nuclear arsenal, because we've seen what happens when people play nice and play ball and cooperate and follow the lead of the United States. I mean, Hussein, Saddam, our boy, our golden boy in the Middle East, learned that the hard way back in the first Gulf War, and Gaddafi in Libya, and many other examples besides. They play ball, they disarm, they open themselves up, and they get completely trammeled. So I think there is some logic to what is going on in North Korea, and dismissing that is done to our own detriment in terms of actually understanding what's going on. Now, Japan's relation to all of this is interesting, I think, because what we're seeing right now is something of a changeover in the status quo in the military situation in the Asia Pacific, with obviously China and its rising naval power and other power becoming a dominant part of the narrative of the Asia Pacific security relationship and framework. And on top of that, you have a United States that at least is talking about pulling back from some of these relationships, make them pay for it, provide their own security, which is fine and all, but it just means that Japan is now wondering what this means, and are we not under the American military umbrella now? What do we do? It just so happens that Japan, although it is not technically a military power, it doesn't technically have an offensive military, it has a self-defense force, which is a military, and all they have to do really is flip that switch, and it is a fully functional, one of the largest militaries on the planet, one of the most well-funded. So, but that is an important window dressing that has been built into the Japanese Constitution, Article 9, saying that there will not be offensive military capabilities, it will not maintain an offensive force. That's a pretty important psychological roadblock, and the Japanese people tend to see themselves as fundamentally pacifist. It's a peaceful nation now. You know, all that warmongering is in the past. So flipping that switch, at least for a few generations, has been very difficult to do, although various people have been trying to do it. I think the Abe government has started to flip that switch and is starting to switch over into the militarization or the remilitarization of Japan, at least in the minds of the Japanese people. And more people are getting on board with that because of the Chinese situation and because of the North Korean situation. So you're right, it is kind of a pivotal point for Japan. And it really could drastically change the entire Asian Pacific security status quo, could drastically change in the coming years.
Well, my question throughout a lot of this has been, who does a conflict with North Korea at this point really, really benefit? I mean, it's clear that, or maybe I'm just off, it doesn't seem like it benefits Japan. It doesn't seem like it benefits South Korea. It certainly doesn't seem like it benefits China. And if none of those countries are being benefited, I don't understand how there's a benefit to the United States. Is this all bluster? Because it really does seem like these anti-missile systems are really going into place. I mean, there's real conflict over it. The North certainly seems to think it's real. China certainly seems to think it's real. Russia seems to think it's real. I mean, they're right there as well. Where is this coming from? This doesn't seem to make any sense at all.
Well, I think the perception of the reality of a threat is itself profitable and lucrative. And we see that because the Asia-Pacific region is one of the regions on the globe with, I don't believe it is the fastest expanding military budgets, but it is up there. And that's obviously directly related to things like the tension with North Korea. And that profits certain people quite handsomely. South Korea, for example, getting into the drone game, buying drones from the usual Lockheed Martins and what have you, and to the tunes of billions of dollars. I mean, there are large contracts that go in, and of course the THAAD missile defense system and all of this. I mean, that's an extreme expenditure that certainly lines certain pockets. So there is a monetary incentive to simply keeping up the perception of the threat. But is it real? Is there really the threat that there will be some sort of military operation there? And I think you're right. It certainly doesn't benefit the South Koreans. I mean, any sort of military operation against North Korea is going to first and foremost and primarily affect everyone on the Korean Peninsula. Right. Seoul is, 30 miles from the DMZ? It's not very far at all. It's spitting distance. And if North Korea is attacked, there is no doubt that they have artillery in place that could reach Seoul. And the Seoul region is where half of the entire population of South Korea actually lives. So that's, I mean, they have the ability to inflict massive damage if anything goes down. So it's certainly not in South Korea's image. South Korea's interest for some sort of military endeavor to go forward. And you're right, China doesn't really want a change in the status quo right now, because China, two reasons. One, the collapse of a North Korean government would potentially mean millions of North Korean refugees fleeing into China, which obviously they don't want to deal with. And secondarily, it means potentially the United States military being directly on China's doorstep, which obviously they don't want. Now, that might be the one reason why it might be interesting to the U.S. military planners, the Dr. Strangeloves in the bowels of the Pentagon and the RAND Corporation and what have you, to actually think seriously about going forward with such an operation, because it does bring that chess piece one step closer, one square closer to the Chinese part of the board, and certainly does more thoroughly contain and surround China in that NATO surround strategy that we've seen going on for many years now. So it is, I think there is some benefit or some potential perceived benefit there that might actually make it an interesting military target for the United States. But I think you're right. No one, I don't think anyone else actually wants a change in the status quo right now. But of course, the status quo really just benefits the warmongers and the hype makers and the people who are selling these defense systems, as well as on the North Korean side, it more strongly rallies the people around the flag and around the government to more thoroughly control basically what's going on in that country. So it really doesn't redound to anyone's benefit.
When we had you on the last time, we discussed that, you know, that China was going to be a big deal for this Trump administration. Clearly it is. You know, to sort of tie in the two conflicts of both of Syria, where you sort of have the, you know, we're now in the multipolar world. So we've got the United States sort of against Russia in Syria, very much so a Syrian client state of Russia. And then you could say North Korea client state, whatever. Their only partner in any way is China. Obviously, there are levers that are being pulled against Russia constantly. We've got new sanctions being talked about, and Trump is all about that. Are there any even levers for this administration that they can even use against China? Because it seems like their relationship with China is one where, you know, the Trump administration is really, really not moving to do anything negative when it comes to China. They're pretty much getting their run of that region. I mean, are there any levers, or are they going to be left alone in this situation?
There are levers, but assuming we're not talking going full out military,
No.
Which I don't think we are at this point, but there are economic and trade levers. But like all of those levers, slapping sanctions or raising tariffs on imports, really, I mean, it's just a tax on the American people at the end of the day, which is the thing that the protectionists don't ever want to admit to, because they've never read Rothbard or anyone who actually has some economic sense on these issues. But that is, I think, the potential lever. They could start to try to, oh, we're going to raise tariffs on your Chinese goods and those types of things. But the surprising thing is we haven't seen much of that yet. Obviously still on the table, and obviously still people in this administration who are very much interested in pursuing that, I think, in the long term. But in the short term, it looks like what they've attempted to do is basically shift the burden of the North Korean situation onto the Chinese, say, this is your problem, you guys deal with it. Again, take the tweets of the POTUS for what they're worth. But it seems that he is unhappy with the way that China has handled the situation and the obviously the July 4th test of the Hwasong 14 ICBM. Seems that, you know, things are there's no significant pressure that's actually derailing anything with regards to North Korea. So, and in fact, if you look at it, it seems that trade between China and North Korea has actually increased this year. So I think the exact opposite of what Trump and the gaggle surrounding him were looking for. So there is the possibility. Again, I mean, it's a question of what time frame and in what way. But again, I think we're going to see questions about the trading relationship between China and the U.S. coming up again in the near future. And I think we're going to see that at least as the potential lever. And as I say, ultimately, it only ends up hurting the American people themselves when they do things like that. But as long as you can be three or four levels of abstraction away from the pain felt by the average American and the actions of the administration, they'll go for it every time.
So I want to talk about, just in case, you know, in the case that this thing turns out to really just be a puppet show, you know what I mean? In the case that this turns out to just be military-industrial complex, well, it is the military-industrial complex trying to soak all the governments involved and all of the players involved. But it seems like this is something that, one, people in the alternative media are coming to really start to talk about. Two, I think it does tie into something that you've been covering a lot lately and we've covered on the show. And I want to see if you feel like there's a tie-in in terms of the way that the establishment, the means that the establishment now is using to extract funds from the government, from governments, and that is on the climate front as well. You know, we recently had this extinction story. We covered it here. I linked to stories that you had done where you just showed time and time and time again that they're hoaxing. It's this trying to find an enemy, and that enemy, be it, you know, some other government, some terrible dictator somewhere. It seems like that motivates the right. The left seems to be very, very quick to, whenever I do a climate story, people attack me instantaneously. I want to get your thoughts on, is that really what we're seeing? Are we just seeing these little puppet shows play out, find an enemy, problem, reaction, solution? Is any of this real? As you've looked at the climate stuff, let's talk climate. Any of the climate stuff, is any of it real at all?
Climate is, I mean, it's an interesting issue because the people who are arguing about it generally don't even know what they're arguing about.
Right.
So, I mean, for example, whenever you actually try to inquire into the scientific roots of this climate kerfuffle that's going on, you'll find people that, for example, will say, well, you know, obviously we've been warming since 1880, therefore global warming, therefore, you know, take your political economic solution from there. Without realizing that the people who are critiquing this are not critiquing the idea that we have been warming since the end of the Little Ice Age. No one is actually critiquing that. The question is the correlation. Is this related to man-made activity? How do we know? How much can we attribute to man-made activity? And how do we critique that? What levels of uncertainty do we have in that? And then from that, well, then what do we do going forward? So people who don't even understand the debate react to it extremely emotionally. Because we're destroying the planet, you know, we ought to do something, think of the children. And by the way, one of the ways to think of the children is to stop having children. Because,
right,
of course, the worst thing you can do for increasing your carbon footprint is to have children.
Right.
Of course, the corollary of that is it would be great for the environment if everyone just killed themselves. And that, you know, I mean, you laugh, but at some point that is going to be, I mean, it really is the ultimate outcome of this.
Well,
this
I said taken to its logical conclusion, it's a death cult, right? We're fundamentally talking about a death cult.
Absolutely, yes. And the worst part is it's a scientifically illiterate, really ham-handed death cult. But at any rate, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you just have to show people some trappings. And I've talked about this in all sorts of different ways in the work that I've done. I've done videos on the very idea of average global temperature, mm-hmm. because people tend to think that this is some thermometer reading that people are getting from somewhere. Oh, the average global temperature today is,
right,
you know, 18 degrees Celsius or whatever. I mean, of course, that's nonsense. So how do they actually construct that figure? When I've gone into that, I've talked about the statistics that they use in the IPCC report that are fundamentally incorrect and are proven so, the $10,000 statistics challenge and other things. So I've talked about all the different scientific layers of this. But again, people react so emotionally to it. And that, at the end of the day, is the very point of this. You're right to basically make some sort of comparison between the boogeyman of the right, which generally tends to be, you know, scary Muslim turban boogeyman that we're secretly funding behind the scenes, or the North Korea situation, or things like that. We'd be very afraid. The boogeyman on the left is humanity. Humanity is a cancer. It's a virus. It has to be eliminated. And you can take that from their own words. The Club of Rome, in their 1991 treatise on the first global revolution, flat out says that in order to basically make humanity into the enemy, we must find something in which humanity is to blame. And global warming fits the bill. That's almost a direct quote. Global warming fits the bill because humans are to blame. So it is about finding an enemy, finding that internal enemy that we can basically use in the same way that that religions have used the idea of the original sin that you must atone for. It's the exact same idea. It's the carbon sin that you must atone for. You breathe carbon dioxide out, you vile cretin. So you must pay your tithe to Al Gore and the UN. And that's what it's about at the end of the day. It's about control. It's the exact same thing. Boogeymen, statists need boogeymen to justify their control. And it's all about justification of control, and it always has been throughout history. And thousands of years ago, it was easier when the pharaoh could say, I am God, I am literally God on earth, so worship me and give me, you know, everything. That had to be modified. You know, going into the Middle Ages, you had to have European monarchs say, no, I'm not God, I'm God's chosen representative. He chose my family to rule over you. People started to call BS on that. And so in the switch over feudalism into capitalism in its early stages, you start to get, well, the scientific revolution. We need a scientific reason for ruling over you. Oh, eugenics. Our genes are just so much better than yours. We deserve the right to rule over you and decide if you can or cannot breed. And ultimately, the end goal of this is to basically create a ruling class, the justification for that ruling class over the serfs, which in the future are going to be genetically engineered to be inferior, or at any rate are not going to get the genetic upgrades. And this isn't, you know, my wild speculation. You can look at mainstream BBC news items from a decade ago. There's one story they had on this, the gene plus or whatever, that are going to populate the earth versus the people who don't get those upgrades. And they show illustrations on BBC News. They show illustrations of what the human race might look like in 1,000 years, and you have these great, giant, hulking, you know, godlike men, and then you have these squat, short, you know, beasts that are roaming about doing the dirty work. It's the Eloi and the Morlock. It's all, I mean, it's just, it's so embedded in our cultural narrative right now, and that's the ultimate end goal of this. And their goal is to make people in their consciousness, in their own mind, believe, yes, I'm not worthy, I'm horrible, I've got this carbon footprint, I have to sacrifice my children to it, I'm not worthy. These people are the golden gods that can fly around in their private jets and solve the problem for us. And a lot of people are, you know, 90% of the way there by just completely investing themselves in this narrative.
You know, I've often thought about the idea that we, although we domesticate species, we have done a pretty good job of domesticating ourselves, and that there's a certain group of people out there, and I think it's the people who have extended from the beginning, when, you know, the pharaoh really was sort of the lord over things, and the people really were kind of livestock. Although now we have a situation where folks like you and I, and a huge growing contingent, it's not like this is new. There's been individualist philosophers for a very, very long time, but it feels like it's mainstreaming in a way that I certainly haven't seen it in my lifetime. People are talking about it more. People are actually making the distinction between these collectivist ideologies and an individualist philosophy. I know that you don't like to use the term anarchist all that often. But voluntarist, I like that as well. How did you come to these? How did you come to this ideologically? I mean, I think there's, you know, we know you for your research. We know you for bringing the cold hard facts. But there's a lot of people who do that never reach this point ideologically. How did you come to the ideology? How did you come to the philosophy for yourself?
Well, actually, as a sidebar, interestingly, I think I'm coming around on anarchism, using that term, but only because it annoys so many people. And I think it's great to do that, to thrust it in people's face. I like it because it annoys people on the sort of left anarchist side. Well, you're not a real anarchist, you know, because anarchism is a socialist movement and all that. You know, look at the history of the term. Well, we're reinventing the term. But then also it annoys all the statists and triggers them. And I think that there needs to be a bit of that thrusting it in people's face. How did I get here? For me, I mean, it really is just taking the facts that I document and that I talk about nonstop in my work and have for the last decade, and applying them consistently towards a political ideology. Interestingly enough, I come from the political left. That is where I started.
As do I, yeah.
Yeah, well, as a Canadian, I was born. Sure. Hey, look, I got my Quebec Nordiques shirt on today. I was born a socialist. You are born and bred a socialist if you're Canadian. And even in Alberta, I grew up in Alberta, which is the Texas of the North and known for its, well, at least previously, I don't know these days, but previously known for its very right-wing sentiments. But I was always on the left. I was always some form of socialist or something, but without being too conscious about it. I thought about it. I took, you know, lots of political philosophy courses in university and things, but I was somewhere in that spectrum. And then I started encountering all this information and that just didn't really fit on that spectrum to me. I didn't know how to locate this. I mean, yeah, the evil right-wingers do evil things, but, you know, staging 9/11 and things like this is just so far beyond anything that you think within that regular left-right paradigm that it does call for some different understanding. And I think that the understanding that comes out of this is the idea of kakistocracy, which is rule by the worst, rule by the most evil. And you can never go wrong, basically, using that as your political assumption, that the most horrible, evil, vile people will rise to the positions of power, because that is how power operates in society. And that's why it no longer surprises me to find the pedophile rings and things at the highest levels of government. Yeah, Dennis Hastert, Speaker of the House, convicted child rapist. You know, I mean, no big deal. Let's just go on as if nothing really happened there. So I was looking at all this information about these vile, psychopathic criminals that are always in charge of the system and basically applied that consistently to go, oh, maybe it isn't a contingency. Maybe it isn't just about voting the right person into power. Maybe the fact that something like 9/11 can happen in the way that it happened and we can be lied to it by both the left and the right shows that this left-right game is nonsense. It doesn't make sense. So how do you put sense into this? And from that point, I think I was ready to hear the logic about it that's articulated by, of course, great people like Larkin Rose, who are great at articulating the actual moral reasons why the idea of a ruling class is not just wrong, it's nonsensical. I mean, there literally is no justification for having a ruling class, but people have been trained into imagining it. And so I think it was the preparatory groundwork, the understanding of all of these facts that led me to the point where I was ready to hear the philosophy. Because if you're not ready to hear it, I think you just don't hear it. You don't care, fundamentally. You can dismiss the idea, oh, yeah, but, you know, think of the real world, James. You know, you're not being practical. Well, no, I am. I'm being very practical. I understand that these horrible, psychopathic, vile people want to control you and your life, and they were the ones who created these positions of power, so of course they're going to fill them. And the logical result of that is we should stop giving them the power. How do you stop giving them the power? Well, you stop participating in their phony rigged game.
Right.
You stop participating in their phony rigged elections in order to justify their rule over you. And I think, you know, voluntarism falls out of that quite easily.
I want to dig a little. This is something that I talk about. I'm realizing I talk about this privately with people a lot. This the idea that we're getting into here with the kakistocracy, is that the right
kakistocracy?
Kakistocracy. Yeah. I speak about this a lot in private, but I'm realizing that it's not something that on the show I've gotten really a chance to sort of go through. So I know that there's some people who are listening right now who heard what you just said, who are still probably a little bit incredulous. But I want to walk through this idea because it's a very important idea, that it's one of those things, once you see it, you can't unsee it. So I want to talk about, because it's very important, very few people are able to come, I think, to this ideology in that way, but I think when you do, it's so powerful. This idea that the state, by definition, is a group with a monopoly on the use of violent force. They can basically have legitimate immoral behavior, robbing, stealing from people, killing people, whatever, and they can make it legal. People have a difficult time making the jump from, they're like, okay, I accept that. And then you say, well, so we shouldn't be surprised that there are the worst type of people. We shouldn't be surprised that there's pedophiles in charge. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute. I want to just, if we could just dig a little further, your thoughts on, because I think about this all the time, and I talk to people about this all the time, the fact that people who even desire the highest level of power in the state are not like you and I in their minds. And could you give your thoughts on that? Or, because I know it's clearly something that you've thought about, to help people to understand that it's like, these are not the same people as you are. It's not even like reptilians. It's not even anything like that. It's just, these are not people who are thinking like you are. Could you expand on that and help people understand that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's a great disservice that we're almost incapable of comprehending the extent to which there are people, clinically, I mean, this is clinically demonstrable, people whose brains function differently than you and I. This is psychopathy. It is a group of people who literally do not experience the human emotions that define yourself and myself and most of the people that we know. The ability to empathize and understand and care about other people on an emotional level is completely missing from a certain section of the population. And there are various estimates as to how great that is, 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%. But at any rate, there is a percentage of the population that you can demonstrate their brains function differently than you or I in a way that is almost incomprehensible to people who have normal empathetic understanding of their fellow human beings, which, I mean, it's a big topic, and I've talked about it quite a number of times over the years on my podcast, including a couple of episodes of my podcast that I did several years ago that have recently been revived for my Corbett Report Extras YouTube channel, where I'm taking some of my old audio-only work and putting it into a YouTube form to help spread the word. So there was an episode I did on, I can't remember what it was called, oh, Our Leaders Are Psychopaths, and Revisiting Psychopathy. And it's a big topic, and of course, the risk is making it into some sort of witch hunt, right, where people just see psychopathy everywhere. Oh, this guy's a psychopath, or just use that term, you know, willy-nilly. But I think we do have to confront the very real reality of a certain group of people that do not experience any sort of empathy with other human beings, and as a result, can inflict the most unimaginable cruelty on other people. Mm-hmm. And not all psychopaths, but certain psychopaths are motivated with a desire to rule over other people. So combine those character traits of a highly motivated person with a desire to rule over people that does not experience a hint of regret or remorse on actions that are so unspeakably cruel that you and I wouldn't even contemplate them. And put that together, and you have a perfect recipe for the most vile and ruthless people imaginable being attracted to these positions where they can live out their fantasies of ruling over other people. It's almost like the system was designed for that express purpose, but at any rate, it's there. There are these troughs of power that who's going to rise to those positions? Is it the people who play nice and think of other people and put other people's interests ahead of their own and work together with others and care? Or is it the people who will slit their own grandmother's throat for the chance of, you know, succeeding, metaphorically or literally? And obviously it's the latter. And that's why psychopaths are people who function, high-functioning psychopaths with certain character traits are the people who rise to the top of corporate pyramids. They're the people who rise to the top of governmental pyramids because they are the ones who will do absolutely anything to achieve the power that they lust after.
And I think that it should be no surprise that this is not something that people have been talking about, and certainly that you're not going to hear establishment individuals talking about, because presumably there's some... the percentage is much, certainly going to be much higher. As you say, like, just the simple market forces of holding this position would be so valuable and so important to this particular individual. It's almost like, look, the people who truly love playing hockey, for instance, you know, are going to be the ones who spend the most time on the ice. Some percentage of them are going to be the ones who wind up being the best at it. Some are naturally going to be talented as well. And so you're going to see those people overrepresented on a professional hockey team. Like, it's just a simple market. So go ahead.
Well, it's even worse, really, because, again, psychopathy only afflicts a small percentage of the population. And again, there are various estimates as to what percentage. But the worst part is that psychopaths can create systems, create hierarchies, and create incentive structures that incentivize people to act like psychopaths. Hmm. And when people are put into those situations, they can become like psychopaths, even if they are not technically, clinically, in terms of their brain chemistry, actually psychopathic. Again, there are different ways that these terms are used, but that's one idea of sociopathy. Sociopaths are people who have been crafted and into a system where they become almost like psychopaths. And the prime examples of that have been studied in recent years come from places like Abu Ghraib, where the sort of average, you know, farm boys and girls from Midwest America go halfway around the world and suddenly are doing these incredibly, insanely torturous, horrible, cruel things to other people that, if they had just been living their lives in the Midwest, probably they wouldn't have done. They wouldn't have acted those things out. They're placed into the situation where it brings them out. This isn't to absolve people of personal responsibility for their actions, obviously, but it does point to one of the sickest parts of the sick system is that when you have, you know, those certain extremely ruthless psychopaths in certain positions of power, they can create a structure around them that actually incentivizes the creation of people like them and moves those people up the ladder. So although most of the population is not psychopathic, there's a slightly larger percentage who can be motivated or incentivized to become sociopathic and will discard their morals and their upbringing as necessary to get ahead in the system. So it's kind of creates this perpetuation of itself. And I think we see that. I think that's part of what we see with the deterioration overall in the idea of the system creating changes in the people should be quite obvious to people who think, if you went back even 20 years ago and talked to the average American and talked about things like, you know, a Department of Homeland Security and TSA and all of these incredible things, they would have said, that's stupid, you know, that's science fiction, that kind of stuff happens in Soviet Russia, that doesn't happen here. And now it is everyday reality, and you know, people join, sign up. Hey, I want to be a TSA agent. I want to work for the DHS. Oh, it's cool. You know, 24 torture. You know, all this stuff. People can be completely switched over if they are placed into a system, and that's, I think, one of the things that these high functioning psychopaths do is create systems that basically incentivize the creation of more people like them.
You know, I travel a lot. I fly very, very often, several times a month, and it's a lot of it domestic here in the States. So I deal with TSA quite a bit. And one thing, it's funny that you actually bring them up in terms of how a system can manipulate individuals. I fly in and out of all of these different airports. And what's crazy is that it's funny because I saw it parodied recently on some YouTube video. It was being parodied, but invariably, there is a guy who is walking around telling people at while they're in line, no water, blah, this, that, the other. And invariably, he always says something like, if you got water, if we see it, I'm going to take you. I'm going to put you to the back of the line. You're not going to get on this plane. All of this. And I'm like, okay, one, I know this person wasn't trained to do that. Two, it's every single place. There's an individual who's doing the same thing and parroting the same. I know this isn't in their training. So it's like, I think this is what you're talking about, that it's like, you can put a system in place where it's just like human beings just going and moving forward, develop these things that seem like they're very personal things. But I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? And that's a concrete example that you could see and point out, but there's myriad different ones.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a growing body of scientific literature that is examining this question of how power, the ability to have power, wield power over other people's, actually changes your brain chemistry and your brain functioning. And there is growing amount of scientific evidence that there really is something to that. And I think that should be obvious, again, in the ways that this is manifested in our society currently. And people who get that taste of power, I mean, before, again, these types of things would have been unthinkable, but once people see it, oh, okay, I can have this power over other people, they start wielding it. I mean, this goes back to the Stanford prison experiments and all of that, that when you put people in those positions of power, they start enacting it and bringing these things into reality.
So this provides also some very, I mean, we're talking about some dark stuff here, but it also provides some hope for those of us who have decided that, look, we'd like to see some other systems, because one of the things that always comes up when you speak with statists is this idea that, and this discussion we're having right now has opened my mind on this to use this as an argument, is this idea that, oh, if the government was gone right now, you know, you can't trust people, the way that they act, it's going to be this, that, and the other. But they're not considering that it may be that people are behaving that way because of the system itself, right? So you talked about withdrawing consent. What are, when you look at the things that the average everyday person can do, I know there's a lot of people who watch the show who are the anarchist voluntarists. They want it, you know, they're looking out and they're like, what can I do as an individual? What can I do? What are the things that you feel are the powerful things that any individual can just do for themselves as actions to really start embodying this?
Well, I think the ground base level of this is cognitive independence, which is easier said than done. But that goes, I think, to the point that we've been making here, is that we are indoctrinated in the society that we grow up in to some extent or other, and it's impossible to escape that. But there are different ways to imagine comporting yourself in the world than what we have been taught, either explicitly or implicitly through what we see. And I always go back to that level of understanding about the education indoctrination system as being the root of so much of what plays out politically. The fact that people can't imagine the world being anywhere any other ways, because of course you grew up in certain systems of control. And I think an excellent, absolutely must see 100%, if I could only recommend one documentary to people, they might be surprised to see that I recommend a documentary called Children Full of Life. It's up on YouTube. Huh. Go watch it.
I'm going to put a link to that. Yeah, very interesting.
It is absolutely essential viewing, because it, I think, really demonstrates, it shows you what a different idea of education could be that would actually potentially lead to people who would be able to imagine the world being in a different way, that things could be more about, well, why do we need the leader authority to tell us? I mean, it's a really wonderful documentary. And I think it's interesting because it's not really to do with the politics side of it, which is what polarizes people and people get into their little camps. This is about children and the way they come to understand and process the world and work with each other in that world. So at any rate, that's something that I would say as sort of the base level of this. And that's why I think this is the idea of moving from a statist world to a post-statist world is obviously an intergenerational effort that will take. I mean, there is no magical switch that can be flipped to suddenly go, you know, okay, now there's no government. And even if there was, even if I had my finger on that switch, I wouldn't flip it
right
overnight. I wouldn't just, okay, you know, done. Now all governments are gone. Because at the very best, you know, the system would return completely overnight.
Right.
I mean, it has to be more fundamental, and people have to have a certain consciousness level before we can transition. And I think the transition is really the important part of this. But having said that, what are things that people can do right now? And of course, it's the things that you can actually do right now. What on earth are you and I going to do about the development of the Hwasong-14 by North Korea and this, you know, these types of situations? You can write your congressman to what? I mean, it's nonsense. The things that we can affect are the things that we do, the things that we participate in, the places that we spend our money, the people that we spend our time with. This is our way of living and interacting and affecting the world. And it's that's why absolutely every fundamental solution comes down to that level of analysis, which is why, in the broad sense, agorism and all of the things that fall under that, I think, is the real way forward in this. It's the not just, I mean, it's not about opposing the system, and it's not just about extracting yourself from that system. It's about building the alternative system.
Yes.
That is the, I mean, if we're going to do something, we have to build the alternative. And that's why agorism in all of its broad sense is ultimately what this is about. Now, different people have different interests and different things, which is why they will gravitate towards certain parts of this or others. The technologically inclined might be more interested in Bitcoin evangelism or finding different ways outside of the monetary paradigm, or people who are more hands-on might want to do guerrilla gardening, you know, grow a garden in your neighborhood and grow a fruit tree and, you know, change people's perception of what nature is and how they relate to it. Again, these things work on an extremely deep level, consciously and subconsciously, to transform our understanding of the world and the way it is. And I think all of those things that people can do to get their hands dirty, literally or metaphorically, are all to the good insofar as they make us once again into actors in this world rather than spectators. Because the ultimate effect of just studying the geopolitical machinations is to put us into that spectator role.
Yes.
Okay, so this is what North Korea is doing. This is what China is doing. This is what Japan's doing. This is what Uncle Sam's doing. You know, what do I do about that? I guess I can, you know, complain about it on Twitter or something. But no, I mean, the things that you actually do in your real life that actually have physical effects on the world make us understand once again, no, the important point is not to be the spectator, it is to be the actor. And that's, again, it's a consciousness thing, and that's why I think at the end of the day, this is about consciousness. This is about our understanding. And here's an interesting point, perhaps, to maybe leave this conversation on,
please,
is the idea of the first follower. There's a great video up on YouTube, and I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, perhaps First Follower. Just type that into YouTube, and you'll see a video of a music festival.
Oh, yes, the Sasquatch Festival, the guy dancing. Oh, what a powerful,
crazy guy gets.
Please explain this. No, please explain this to the people, what happens.
So there's a music festival, and this guy gets up, and he's doing this crazy dance, and everyone's just kind of tittering at him. Oh, you know, he looks kind of strange, and it's just like a joke. This guy's just crazy. But then someone else gets up and starts dancing with the guy. And suddenly, I mean, it's, again, it's kind of fun. It's funny. Oh, you know. And so a few more people join in, and then a few more. And then suddenly, literally everyone at this festival is up and dancing and doing this crazy thing. And it's the point of this is that it's the social proof of seeing someone else who does this as well. Oh, it's not. Okay, so it's not crazy. I mean, I can do it. I mean, it's fun. Let's just join in. And that's an important point of all of this, is that, again, we tend to, I mean, the ultimate part of so much of the propaganda indoctrination we get is that you are alone, you are isolated, you're an individual, you're helpless. All you can do is to pull a lever every 4 years, and that is your participation in this system. And don't think about doing anything more. We need people to talk about, articulate these ideas and these concepts so that other people can look and say, oh, well, other people see this as well. Other people think this. Other people are doing something about this. I can do it too. And that's why, I mean, I don't want to put ourselves on a pedestal, but conversations like this one and millions of others that are happening every day and increasingly in the online sphere are important in, if for nothing else than to get people to understand that they are not alone in what they're thinking and doing. And that's an exceptionally important part of all of this, to understand we are active, we're not spectators, we are choosing the life that we want to live and the people that we want to live with and the things that we spend our time and money on. And those are our ways of affecting reality. We can reshape this planet. We can reshape the world. It does not have to be the way it is right now. And I think that's the most important message that we can put out there for now. As people start to flex their muscles, it's like any other muscle. You train it, it will get bigger over time. And that's the point.
James Corbett, powerful, a powerful message. I want to thank you for the work that you've done. We're talking about building the Agora, and if there's anybody who has contributed to the knowledge base, I think, of the people who, as new people are going to come into this, and you've already laid so much of a groundwork for them to be educated in what's going on, what's happened in the past, and what's coming in the future. I want to thank you for that. I mean, there's not enough praise, I think, that people could heap on the work that you're doing, and thank you for continuing to do it. Thank you for being on the show, and we'll have you again soon, I hope.
All right. Well, looking forward to it. Thank you again for the work you're doing.
Great. Thank you, James.